Nazis' World War II occupation of Greece is closed, and the government itself isn't prepared to discuss the issue further with Athens. Greek Prime Minister Alexis Tsipras revived the question of wartime reparations on Tuesday, saying that his debt-ridden country has never been fully compensated by Germany. The issue has heightened tensions between Athens and Berlin at a time when negotiations over Greece's financial bailout are ongoing. German Finance Ministry spokesman Martin Jäger said Wednesday that Berlin believes the issue was resolved in a 1960 accord, but added that Germany is very serious about its historical responsibility.
But this changes nothing about our position and our strong conviction that the question of reparations and compensation has, in our opinion, been resolved, finally and conclusively.
Geklärt ist, abgeschlossen ist.
A Greek minister said he was ready to endorse a court ruling.
And hello. If you've just joined us, please stay tuned for our regularly scheduled program of Indigenous Talk Radio with the Angry Indian on Intelligent Aboriginal Radio.
You are listening to Angry Indian Radio, the podcast of the Aboriginal Press News Service.
Find us on the web, ang-newswire.blogspot.com.
I think Angry Indian is one of those people who likes to walk up to two guys and say, let's see you and him fight.
Internet radio for smart Aboriginals.
Okay, welcome back to Intelligent Aboriginal Radio. Follow me on Twitter, which, if you're not aware, is The Angry Indian on Twitter. I've been criticized in person and online for not really jumping on to the Dolce & Gabbana boycott. And my reason for this is the comment that they made about the IVF children of the world. I'm not on that, you know. I'm against GMOs. You know, I wasn't for Dolly the Sheep, and I'm not with that. Now, I don't know what it is that they said about gay families that offended anybody. I mean, these are two gay men, two European gay men. I have to point that out, because there is a difference. People in the United States think the world revolves around the United States. It does not. They don't necessarily go on these bandwagons. People have opinions. And again, I'm not exactly clear. I mean, I've looked around and I'm still looking for what it was that was really, really offensive. That Elton John felt that he was being targeted personally, that he had to start this campaign. But what really gets me about the campaign with this is Sir Elton John is a close friend, by his own admission, of hate radio host here in the United States, Rush Limbaugh. Rush Limbaugh insults the gay community at every given opportunity. He insults every minority, ethnic minority, within the United States, because the real minorities are Caucasians worldwide. But the point is, he's a bigot. And, you know, the idea of gay marriage, I mean, the only person that I'm aware of that he's ever given a pass to was Dick Cheney's daughter, who is married to her lesbian partner, and they have two children this way. Now, I'm not trying to insult anybody, and I'm not going to necessarily say artificial children, but I'm going to say it's definitely not normal. And as I asked my guest, who, you know, I'm really excited to have on, Toronto director Bruce LaBruce, you know, both are looking at the hypocrisy of a lot of this. And while I was talking about his angle to Rush Limbaugh, Bruce found out that he was photographed just recently with a Dolce & Gabbana bag. If not right after he started the boycott. So, you know, what the hell is really going on with someone like Elton John, who can say that Rush Limbaugh, a known bigot, and a known bigot to gay people, how can he be friends with him and then be angry with Dolce & Gabbana for having an opinion? You know, from what I saw, I don't think they told anybody to do anything. Rush Limbaugh tells you not to be gay. And then he tells people who don't like you to be gay that they have a right to beat you up. that they have a right to deny you employment, that they have a right to deny you housing, they have a right to deny you even education, they have a right to deny you to your children, however they want. There's a certain hypocrisy that's going on in the gay community, and, you know, we have to talk about this. I mean, in my particular circle, we're fans of Queer as Folk, not the British version. We prefer the Canadian one, right? And Brian, the most honest character on the entire goddamn show, came up with the term Stepford fags. And we've adopted it because we've watched a lot of people who used to run around and were very free and did whatever the hell they wanted to, and some were just flat-out sluts. Call it what it is. And now all of a sudden they're pushing baby carriages. And they're angry with their gay friends. And I mean angry with their pals who don't want to do this, who don't want to get married.
There's a lot of moralizing going on, I found. You see it on the internet all the time. Slut shaming and that sort of thing.
And that sort of thing. Well, anyway, so let's welcome Bruce LaBruce. Welcome to Intelligent Aboriginal Radio.
Thanks for having me.
Yeah, so, you know, I wanted to have you on, and we're going to talk about your film, because I dig film, in a little bit, and how your films tie into a lot of this, because they definitely do. And the fact that you and I, you know, both saw the hypocrisy in what Sir John is doing, coming from two different angles.
It's not about the bag. I mean, the bag, I think there's even some question of whether the photograph was taken after he made the comment or something. But, you know, that was just kind of a joke I made on Twitter, like maybe he's using it as his diaper bag. But what I think the real root of it to me is, like, it's not only... I mean, it's always a kind of a class issue for me, for one thing. I mean, this idea of all these enormously wealthy people, and, you know, in the States, the gap between the haves and have-nots is historically, you know, huge. And so, you know, if Elton John is friends with Rush Limbaugh, it's because they're both, like, you know, gazillionaires who have more in common with each other than, you know, than Elton John would have with any kind of working class or middle class kind of gay person. So, and also, there's with all these, you know, ideas of in vitro or any kind of, or women, you know, saving their eggs so that they can have later pregnancies, it's very expensive, you know, and not everyone has that luxury or can afford to do that. So there's a lot of issues in terms of class and celebrity that people don't talk about when these kinds of things come up.
Well, yeah, I mean, in terms of the class aspects, in terms of how the gay community is analyzing this, you're the only person I've heard so far that even mentioned the fact on how expensive this procedure is, and it would totally, you know, leave most couples, gay couples, out of the loop.
Yeah, sure.
In terms of an option for something like this.
Yeah, I mean, it's like, it's kind of, in a way, it's kind of like problems of the wealthy white class, you know. That's the people who have access to most of these kinds of procedures. You know, I've been researching a script recently that has to do with abortion, and I mean, it just kind of blew my mind how these kinds of issues are taking all the attention, and this idea of, you know, raising children when it's still not even in Canada, you know, it's very difficult for women to get to have an abortion, and it's still a taboo, and there's an increasing kind of right-wing opposition against it, and so, you know, it's and it, this again is not is an issue of class. I mean, it's people who just who can't afford to have a child at a certain time in their life, and it's just an option that they're choosing out of necessity. So anyway, it just makes when it's these rich people, like these uber wealthy people, who are having a little spat over, you know, their philosophy of family and how gays should whether they should raise children or not or whatever. I mean, it seems like so ridiculous that it's these uber rich fashion people are having this argument that doesn't even relate to the average experience of most people.
Okay, so now that that's come out, you know, what is the average experience of the, say, average, you know, gay-identified person in North America right now? You know, looking at the political climate that is moving very, very fast to the right, be it Mexico, be it the United States, be it Canada, India, most of Western Europe, you know, we're looking at a very serious shift. And I'm seeing it even within the gay community, a very serious shift to a conservatism that really doesn't look at all like honest conservatism. I mean, it leans very, very far to the far right.
Yeah, and it's to the point where, you know, millennials have been born into this kind of this right wing, reality. So younger people don't even remember a time when socialism, for example, was part of the kind of equation, especially in Canada. I mean, it was socialist leaning in the 60s and 70s. So this kind of shift to the right is being ingrained in people because they don't remember when there was a different reality. So the same for me, is true of the gay movement, the black movement, the feminist movement. They're now kind of all, they've gone into the stage of being completely about reformist rather than revolutionary. They're kind of ignoring or forgetting the roots of all these movements, which were very class-based, very socialist, sexually revolutionary, that's partly a symptom of when revolutionary movements, gain a foothold in some kind of political, real politics. Then they start to adapt or kind of shift towards reform. But it's gotten to the point where I think people have really lost sight of what it means to be against the status quo and to challenge corporate, institutions and challenge, like you say, this shift to the right way. It's much more about people thinking being empowered means succeeding in a reality, no matter how corrupt it is, a corporate reality or a government reality.
Well, as an artist and as a film director, where do you see the responsibility for those people who do know better, who work within the industry, that have in some ways maybe led to total saturation, like say with a television show like Glee, and then will have Fox News that will totally have just the opposite of everything that Glee is about? And I believe it's actually a part of that network. The show Empire, which is based on a black family running a music industry empire, basically. This is on Fox News. Now, that they will use these elements to make money, to draw people in. But then at the same time, you have Sean O'Hannity, you have Bill O'Reilly, you have, just pick your far-right pundit that cuts up, minorities, they cut up gay people, transgender people right now seem to be the biggest target. You know, one of the things down here is the restroom issue.
Yeah.
So, where does media fit in with this? How do we have Glee and then we have that, and they both come from the same network, and we have young people who are raised on both?
I don't watch Glee. I've watched a couple of episodes of Empire, but I mean, it's a strategy that the right wing uses, or that Fox uses, is that, they have to demonstrate a certain amount of tolerance and kind of in a kind of backhanded way, and they don't have to on Fox News, you know, they're on in with their pundits or with their agenda, but they are a multinational corporation, and they can't only pander to the base all the time, you know. So that's probably the strategy behind it, I would think.
Well, I mean, maybe, you know, with part of it, but I still find the dichotomy a bit glaring, because here it is, they will have these things, and then, or they'll produce this sort of entertainment, let's say, because that's what it is entertainment. There's no information really being transferred, you know, back and forth. And when it's, you know, you go and you say to, you know, some of these people, well, Fox can't be all that bad. They're doing Glee. Yeah. They do Empire, you know. Comes into the class aspect again, because when you look at the commercials, it's these, you know, very up-to-date vehicles, Whole Foods, you know, a lifestyle that the majority of people who are watching this, you know, they're working on minimum wage.
Ooh.
Surviving on minimum wage, you know, and the black market, you know, let's be honest about that too. And there's so many young gay people that are out on the street that are, you know, hustling because they've been thrown out of the house and what have you. And, you know, I really don't understand why that is still such a marginal issue in the gay community, and as opposed to, say, this Dolce & Gabbana freakout, which isn't going to last very long.
Well, these are all, those are all distractions, like I said. That's like a spat between two uber-wealthy people that doesn't really have any bearing on the lives of ordinary people. So I think it's a matter of these shows, maybe, you know, all of these shows, these network shows, are still very capitalist. I mean, I feel like I'm one of the few people who still presents themselves as an anti-capitalist. But it's you know, they present a certain lifestyle that I don't agree that entertainment doesn't matter, because that's how, you know, that's how the dominant ideology, you know, infiltrates the consciousness of the people, you know. So it's like a kind of propaganda, and it, you know, it's, most of it is like very about people who are participating in the corporate world and want to succeed within it. You know, we could get into the whole pop culture thing where, I mean, I shouldn't get into the Beyonce debate, because I wrote a kind of critique of Beyonce in Vice a couple of years back, and, you know, some people wanted to kill me, but, you know, this idea that it's participating in the system as it exists, and trying to kind of present it as something progressive or something liberating, but actually it's very very much consistent with the system that continues to oppress you know, minorities and disenfranchised people and the working class. And I mean, that's the only kind of working class characters that really exist are like Honey Boo Boo, or, you know, these kind of reality TV shows, Hillbilly Hand Fishing or whatever. That's how the working class is now portrayed. Whereas in classic Hollywood, as I always argue, there was like, you know, there was a whole tradition of making films about films that are very honest and supportive of the idea of the working class and people who are opposed to the corporate greed or corruption or the corrupt government or whatnot. So that doesn't really exist anymore in Hollywood, that kind of oppositional
Do you think it's possible to, for a new, relative, modern, not a copy, make sense on the waterfront today?
Well, on the waterfront is very problematic because it's anti-union, you know. So that's not the best example.
What I mean is in terms of a message, because the way that that was sold to me as a young person was that this was a film that I had to watch, that it was a message film.
Yeah.
Now, they didn't tell me what the message was.
Right, sure. But you're right. I mean, message films were, I mean, you look at someone like, you know, anyone from Capra to a number of directors, classic directors who were, you know, the working class was presented, and labor movements, I mean, were presented as something noble and something without being condescending, you know, something that people should aspire to and should respect, and that it wasn't about the only way that people could have any self-respect is to try to get out of where they were, to get out of being working class, and now it's the only thing is that people aspire to be is like rich celebrities who then can argue about whether you should be having a baby or not, you know.
Well, they're cutting education here, you know, they're slashing it as much as they possibly can, and Harper's doing the same thing, trying to tie initiatives into slashing, you know, housing, slashing, you know, budgets for this, you know, slashing to the First Nations and what have you. How much further or how much longer do you think the general public, especially those that are being victimized by this sort of class war, are going to allow this to continue?
I mean,
in North America, I mean.
Yeah, I mean, it's extremely difficult now in terms of protests and I mean, the anti-labor movement is astonishing how labor unions have become so discredited and kind of dismantled, you know, in the UK as well, so and everywhere. So it's also extremely different with the consolidation of the media, you know, through corporate entities. It's hard to build any kind of oppositional movement these days. So the militarization of the police, the way that protests are dismantled, and protests, even protest kind of groups are infiltrated and discredited. So I mean, it's really difficult in Canada right now. The government's trying to pass Bill C-51, which really increases their ability to do surveillance on oppositional movements, and it's kind of clamping down on dissent. And so I don't know. It seems like a very difficult landscape now to negotiate for any kind of ground roots oppositional kind of movements to gain any traction.
Well, I mean, in terms of hashtag activism, I believe it was Elton John or his people that started the boycott Dolce & Gabbana hashtag on Twitter.
Mm-hmm.
You know, that's another question I can ask you. You know, in terms of the class aspects, I mean, poor people simply do not have computers and do not have internet access. I know that for a fact. Native American First Nations people, we do not really have access to a lot of this, and not very many people are knowledgeable enough to teach us how to use these things. How is that activism going, in your view, as someone who was educated by Marxist, knowledgeable people? You know, how do you evaluate the new activism then, you know, now that it's moving from the street in North America, seems to be moving from the street to the internet, but in Europe, 10,000 people just stood against austerity in Germany yesterday.
Mm-hmm. Well, I mean, I think it does translate, it can translate into practical realities, and and kind of real time kind of activism. It's just, that's what happened with the Arab Spring. I mean, there was a lot of hashtag activism that kind of kickstarted that revolution, even though it didn't end so well. But if you don't have the mindset that hashtag activism, it only remains kind of in that realm, like on the virtual realm, and that it's meant to have an impact on actual, you know, everyday, more practical and kind of ground level activism, then I think it can be quite effective. I mean, the internet still, maybe not for long, but it still is one of the great kind of free spaces for free thought and kind of opinion, and it's kind of still somewhat democratic in that regard. So people can have their voices heard on it, and actually try to make an impact on the real world.
Okay, we're going to take a quick break. We're speaking with director Bruce LaBruce. And we're going to talk about film. We're going to talk about his film and how the medium of film relates to the questions, the struggles, the movements that are happening right now that, you know, people are trying to be heard, and there are people who are fighting not to hear it. This is Intelligent Aboriginal Radio. Please stay tuned.
Angry Indian Radio. He is not only for Indians, but he is also for blacks and other minorities. And they have done a lot on the problems in Palestine and also the problems of blacks. And so I recommend that you listen to him.
When I was a fool, before I surrendered myself to the Lord Jesus Christ, I was an absolute hedonist. I smoked dope. I did everything that might feel good.
No, so you've never, no girlfriend of yours ever had an abortion?
No. In fact, the women that I got pregnant did not kill my children. So God's grace.
By the way, it also points out that in an Esquire magazine interview, you acknowledged taking part in homosexual sex and bestiality in the 70s.
that's my point, Alan. I mean, just
is that
because,
true?
Because it's printed in the news media or on the internet, everybody is jumps to believe it. But in reality, if I say the truth,
is that true?
People say that's not. Hey, Alan, if you want to accuse me of having sex when I was a fool, I did everything that crossed my mind that looked
yes,
like it might feel good.
You had sex with animals
as an active hedonist. Absolutely. I was a fool.
You had sex with animals?
Oh, when you grow up on a farm in Georgia, and your first girlfriend is a mule.
I'm not so sure that's so...
That's because you didn't grow up on a farm in Georgia. Fact of the matter is, don't know that in fact you experiment with anything that moves when you're growing up sexually, you're naive, and you know better than that. You know yourself. If it's warm and if it's damp and it vibrates, you might in fact have sex with.
You are listening to Angry Indian Radio, the podcast of the Aboriginal Press News Service.
Hello, I'm Carol Gordon. Traditionally, Native women made all decisions regarding their reproductive health care. This was respected as women's business. Today, we are basically denied this decision-making power. It's time to take back that power of making decisions concerning our reproductive health. There is a choice we can make regarding unwanted pregnancy. Plan B is an emergency contraceptive that must be taken within 72 hours after having unprotected sexual intercourse in order for it to be effective in preventing pregnancy. Contact your local Indian Health Service facility and ask if they carry Plan B. If not, tell them to order it. Plan B is an OTC, over-the-counter contraceptive, and a prescription is not necessary. You have a legal right to access this contraceptive over-the-counter. This message is brought to you by the Native American Women's Health Education Resource Center.
Every day, one more Aboriginal person will test positive for HIV. Some will be rejected by their family, friends, and community. They will live in isolation, their voices no longer heard. HIV/AIDS stigma and discrimination denies our people the right to protect their future. You can make a difference. Be their voice. End HIV/AIDS stigma and discrimination. Get information from your community health center or nursing station, or visit www.caan.ca.
Roseanne Cash for the American Association of Diabetes Educators.
Johnny Cash was my dad. For years he had diabetes but ignored it, even as his vision and health slipped away. Diabetes is serious. It can steal your sight, your limbs, even take you away from the people who love you. But it doesn't have to be this way. If you have diabetes, test and control your blood sugar regularly. You'll be healthier and you'll feel better too. To learn more, visit healthywithdiabetes.org.
I like going to cons. I like meeting my fans. I like meeting other writers and podcasters. And I like getting a chance to meet the authors I admire, and even the occasional celebrity. You know what else I like? I like being around people, women especially, who act flirty, dress sexy, and don't mind being looked at once in a while. I'm a married man, but you know, when I stop looking, it'll be time to bury me. But you know what? Some of you fuckers are spoiling it for the rest of us. When you assholes, and you know who you are, go putting your hands where they don't belong, you're spoiling it. I've seen you fuckers. I've heard the stories. Brushing up against someone in the hall. Copping a feel when you think you can get away with it. Treating a human being like a sex toy because you think your desires and a bit of skin give you the right to grope anyone you like. You're spoiling it for the rest of us. Because you know what happens when someone gets treated that way? They retreat. They treat anyone who even looks at them as if they're committing a crime. They distrust. They dress down, trading short skirts and low necklines for loose t-shirts and sweatpants. They scorn. And eventually, they stop coming to cons at all. And then all of us pay the price because you couldn't keep your filthy paws to yourself. So get this, you goddamn dirty ape. Next time I see this happening, I'm calling you on your shit. You are going to be the one who gets humiliated. You are going to be the one sticking your tail between your legs. You are going to be the one that's sorry you came to the con. And don't think that just because you're not a man, or that your target isn't a woman, that I won't step in just as hard, because I will, motherfucker. And it goes just the same outside the con, too. Doesn't matter where I see you, I will stop you. And I'm not the only one who's going to be keeping my eye out, either. You can fucking count on it.
I don't care. So you said.
fill me with inertia.
Hey everybody, it's Dr. Vibe, the host and producer of the Dr. Vibe Show at thedrvibeshow.com. At our show, we do conversations and provide information for black men and those who love them. So come check us out. Also at iTunes, and also selective episodes are featured at the Good Men Project, one of the most viewed websites in the world for men. So find out about black men and those who love them at the Dr. Vibe Show.
This is Kristen Hirsch from Throwing Muses, and you're listening to a podcast released under a Creative Commons license.
Go fuck yourself. Fuck yourself. Fuck yourself. Go fuck yourself.
Folks, it's time for the infamous Al Goldstein Fuck You Department.
Good evening. This is Al Goldstein from Midnight Blue. Several weeks ago, I attacked the Cineplex Odeon Theater chain for doing some scandalous thing, which is to run visual ads. It's an outrage. I paid $7.50 to see a movie recently. I was allowed to charge a big deal. But then I actually had to sit through a Coca-Cola ad. It made a real big mark on my brain, and an American Express ad. What a ripoff. What a fucking ripoff. That would be like HBO showing ads for American Express. The point being, when you go to a movie theater and pay $7.50, you don't want to look at advertising material. And I was recently in Germany, and I saw a movie there. In fact, Spike Lee's film, Do the Right Thing. I saw it in Berlin with the German subtitles. And what shocked me was at the theater I went to, they had 26 minutes of ads. 26 minutes of ads. That's what's going to happen. If you don't boo the ads at the Cineplex, if you don't rise or raise your voice in complaint, you are going to go the way that the docile and passive Germans have gone, and Europeans, who are inundated with ads when they go to a movie theater. So rise up. At least have the self-respect to quit being shit on. Yell at the theaters. How dare they have you pay to see ads? So Cineplex Odeon and your odorous president, go fuck yourself.
Well, it appears the Goldstein curse has struck again. Since airing this piece originally on Midnight Blue a couple of weeks ago, Mr. Drabinsky, CEO of Cineplex Odeon, was forced to resign his job. Go get a job. And Cineplex Odeon, $7.50 ain't enough. You got to give us goddamn commercial? Fuck no!
This is DJ Fusion of the Fusebox Radio Broadcast and BlackRadiosBack.com. You're now listening to Intelligent Aboriginal Radio, another slice of real black radio for the masses. All right? Peace.
This is APNS Public Radio.
Just when you thought it was safe to turn your radio back on.
Gee, when you're having sex on camera, and there's like a certain angle that the camera has, and there's two penises and one female, and there's one penis in one hole and another penis in another. Have you guys ever done that? Is that something?
I've done, like, if they're both in the pussy, they're double vag. If they're both in the ass, they're double anal.
And the best is combo PBDA. Classic.
Have any of you guys done that?
I don't think there's a word if it one's in the mouth and one's in the pussy though. But if you got one in the ass and one in the pussy, then it's double penetration.
DP.
How do you mentally prepare for that? Like, is that even pleasurable?
I've never done it. I do double vag, but I don't do any of the other ones. Yeah.
Yeah. Excuse me. What do you think of Sarah J? She does double vag. Yeah. She doesn't do
double
DVD.
Vag. No, now, just double what's vag. That like? Is that pleasurable?
You know what? For me, it's more mentally pleasurable than anything. Like, I totally, explain. Like, I get excited about just thinking about it. I'm like, let's do that. Can we do that today?
So, what do you do after this?
No. You know, it's exciting
with
to me.
Any other double anything.
Especially right? Sharing the same room.
It's like they're touching.
Oh, no, they're touching. They're
first of all, I get
other.
Excited because it doesn't happen every day. Like, how many girls get to say that they've had two penises inside one hole at the same time? Like, that's kind of exciting.
Only really lucky girls.
Right. That's kind of the way I feel about it. Like, really, really lucky girls. And then the fact that these two guys are touching inside my vagina.
They're willing to be gay.
They're
want to fuck
to
you
be,
so much.
Thank you. That's exactly.
These guys
want to
fuck
exactly
so bad. They'll rub
so
cocks with
really,
another guy.
It's really my mental is like really stimulated during it, and then it kind of makes my pussy wet, and it's a very exciting time. It's like
okay,
Christmas.
Other than mentally, physically, is
you feel very full. It's kind of incapacitating. You got to just hold still.
Okay.
Because like I haven't had a kid, so I'm not like huge. Mm-hmm. You know, like I haven't been stretched out like that far before. Mm-hmm. So I just got to hold still and
wait for it.
Yeah, think, wait, time. Right, totally just like
think of a happy place.
Yeah, think, lube it up and just think happy thoughts. And once it gets in there and gets going, it's pretty decent, but you just got to hold still. Yeah.
Gianna,
you're very full.
Do you do ooh. Anal?
You know, I have done one film.
Just one? Just I hope one. You got a hefty check for that one.
Who is the anal with?
Michael Stefano.
Oh, okay.
Oh, the great
okay.
Michael Stefano.
Yeah, yeah.
Love his
yeah,
work.
I like his early work.
No, well, let's be honest. Right. His later stuff is not the same.
Really?
I'm joking. Neither of us, we don't know who he is. We're just making fun.
Oh, that's funny.
We're just being assholes. But why asshole. Only one? I thought the point is you keep that ass on lock.
Have you ever got fucked in your ass?
Whoa.
Turn off the camera. Pause the cameras.
Intelligence Aboriginal Radio.
Okay, this is Intelligent Aboriginal Radio. Welcome back. And we're still in the virtual studio with Bruce LaBruce, who is coming at you straight from Toronto, Canada. He is one of, I like to think, one of the more deeper directors. And I'm not saying that just because I have him here. He reminds me, and I told him, the first film I saw from him, what year was that? 1993. No Skin Off My Ass.
It was 91.
Oh, it was 91? Okay, yeah, my notes here are wrong. Okay, so 1991, No Skin Off My Ass, which was about a hairdresser meets a skinhead and things develop. It was the first film I had seen like that. It was shocking at first to me because I had never seen anything like that. But at the same time, I had moved over from German underground art house films, and namely, as I told him, the Tortoise King, the Death King, which was pretty gruesome in many ways, but the cinematography was what I was interested in, and I kept looking at his work after that, and you know, the questions that he raised in his films, from Hustle of White, Super 8.5, from The Raspberry Reich. He's got some recent films out now that I understand a lot of people aren't particularly crazy about, L.A. Zombie, or Otto, or Up With Dead People. You know, he is a director that goes very, very far in terms of looking where the boundaries are and looking past them. And I wasn't aware of this. He also turns out to be a prolific writer. He has written for Vice, Nerve.com, Black Book Magazine. He also has, is it one or two books out? The Reluctant Pornographer?
Reluctant Pornographer was, in the late 90s. And Ride Queer Ride is more of a kind of catalog essays about my films. I have another one, a more image-based book called Bruceploitation that's came out in Europe last year.
Okay, so, you know, like I said, you know, he's worth looking at. And the fact that when you bring up his name sometimes will cause a variety of reactions means that he's actually touching nerves.
I should mention that my most recent film, Gerontophilia, is my first film ever without sexually explicit scenes in it. And but it's still kind of creating controversy because it's about an 18-year-old boy who has a fetish for the a sexual fetish for the elderly. And he falls in love with one particular 81-year-old man when he gets a job working in a assisted living facility. So it's super intergenerational love, but it's a love story, and you know, it's all gonna be part of my I have a retrospective happening at MoMA, the Museum of Modern Art, film retrospective, starting April 23rd. And it kicks off with a screening of Gerontophilia. So people should check it out. The main character plays the 81-year-old man you would love, and you should interview him sometime. His name is Walter Borden. He's a kind of legendary Canadian actor, activist. He's mixed race, identifies as black. He's from the East Coast. He was known as Canada's only Black Panther in the 60s. He's been a gay and black activist his whole life. He's 83 now. He's still going strong, doing theater, and he's quite a remarkable man. He was total colorblind casting. The role of the old man wasn't really written for any race in particular, and we cast him, and he's wonderful in it.
Yeah, I see this film is described as a gay Harold and Maude.
Yeah, kind of. I mean, but it really crosses a lot of boundaries, because the boys, you know, like in Harold and Maude, the boy's fixation is kind of a sexual fetish, but it also involves empathy and kind of real kind of reverence for the elderly, and it gets into a lot of issues of how the elderly have become increasingly disposable in our culture, and it's a very touching film.
All right, so let's start talking about your films and how all of this relates. What, you know, like when I went for coffee yesterday, like I was telling you when we were warming up, I mentioned your name, and you know, ears pricked up. And they weren't kind,
and,
you know,
and
they
coffee, like, and coffee was spit out.
Yeah, you know, it was, and I asked them, how many of you have actually seen any of his films? Only one person raised their hand.
Well, that's the thing. I mean, people often associate my name with pornography or extreme kind of violent imagery, gore, gorn, which I've done. But, you know, as I think I mentioned to you, a film like L.A. Zombie, which is probably my most extreme film, which is a gore porn, is really about much more than that. And it's kind of about taking that genre, which does exist. I mean, you know, there's a lot of extreme horror films out there, but it's, you know, taking it from a completely different angle. So this film is about a kind of alien zombie, but he's really a homeless schizophrenic who has the delusion that he can fuck dead bodies back to life. So he sees himself as a kind of savior. And it's really a kind of this melancholy mood piece about the disenfranchised, the homeless in LA, who wander around in this, you know, dream factory of Hollywood, and they're like the seedy underbelly of Hollywood, who've been disposed of and who nobody wants to acknowledge because of the film industry. And so that's the aspect of Hollywood that interests me, is that always interests me, is the outcasts and the people that they try to sweep under the carpet. So the film has a kind of political angle, for sure.
Well, your Hustler White reminded me of the book Hollywood Babylon.
Mm-hmm. It was a kind of partly an homage to that. But it's also, again, about, you know, it was about, set in the male prostitution street scene on Santa Monica Boulevard, which was at the time being kind of systematically destroyed by the police. They were harassing these hustlers and kind of arresting them. This is in the mid 90s for anything, for spitting on the street or vagrancy or whatever, and they really kind of drove them off the boulevard. So it's kind of a half documentary about this dying street prostitution scene in LA.
Yeah, was that Tony Ward before or after he became famous?
Well, he'd been underground famous for a while, and he had just had this high profile affair with Madonna, and we cast him just within a year of him breaking up with her. So that got a lot of the film a lot of attention, and it was like a cult hit internationally.
Well, I mean, Ron Athey, I'm sure, got you a lot of.
And Ron Athey as well, who's a great friend of mine, and he still, and you know, he had not so long before the film, he had, you know, had been one of the four artists who were denounced by a senator.
Yeah, it was the National Endowment for the Arts. Yeah, they were supporting him, and yeah. The Republicans in the Senate and some conservative Democrats really came down. They wanted to cut all funding for all art, period.
Yeah. So, I mean, and his work was, you know, very much about HIV and about the kind of contamination of the blood, but how also the idea of the homosexual had become some kind of contamination, and people at the time thought that they could get it from being in the same room with a homosexual or rubbing against a homosexual, you know. So his work was very political in terms of, again, it's very extreme, it's very bloody, it's kind of body modification and cutting the body and on stage and etc. But it's done in a very, it's very poetic, it's very historical, he references all kinds of ritual and kind of religious ritual, so it's very profound, actually.
Yeah, so one of the things I wanted to ask you about was the issue of masculinity, and not so much it automatically includes, I would assume, the gay male, because one of the questions that someone wanted me to ask you was, if, you know, being that you do the type of work that you do, so he felt that you would have some familiarity with mainstream pornography here in the States. And one of the questions he wanted me to ask you was, being that he feels that what you do is, you know, leans towards art,
mm-hmm.
As opposed to what is, you know, gonzo porn here, and the terms of masculinity, because it's come out recently that double penetration in women, vaginally, anally, orally, that's become a big thing. Ooh. And that supposedly it popped up, at least in the States, that is used mostly in interracial pornography here, which is also weird, because when you look at the credit card records, you know, who's actually buying this stuff is from all of what is called the red states here, all of the conservative states. Ooh. The church going to the Bible Belt, right? Yeah, so, yeah. You know, in terms of masculinity, you know, we're seeing a blending, or at least I feel that I am, cuckolding, all of this sort of stuff is becoming much more mainstream. Now, how is it that, you know, work that you do has sometimes automatically been painted with pornography?
Yeah, it's complicated, because I completely express solidarity with pornographers. I support people in general who make porn and who perform in porn. I mean, there's no question that the porn world can be exploitative, and that there's a lot of problems with mainstream pornography, and most mainstream pornography doesn't interest me at all. But I still express solidarity with pornographers, and I don't mind people calling me a pornographer. I do consider myself an artist who works in porn and who works with porn conventions and kind of which is why I wrote a memoir called The Reluctant Pornographer, because I do see that there can exploit people, it can be problematic, especially the industry kind of porn side of it. And especially, I think, more in the straight porn world than in the gay porn world. In the gay porn world, there's more of a kind of egalitarian relationship between all the performers that is much different from the straight porn world. But having said that, I mean, I think, first of all, there's a lot of hypocrisy going on, like this. Red state people consuming this pornography, as you mentioned, most people really totally look down at their nose at pornographers and kind of judge them morally, people who perform in it, people who make it, and yet they're the ones who watch it. I mean, how does it get, it doesn't get magically made. I mean, someone has to make it. And the people who make it are, you know, are quite often creative people. I mean, it was more true in the 60s and 70s when porn was made on film. It was more kind of, it could be more kind of leaning towards the artistic or cinematic side of things. But anyway, I mean, I don't judge people who are in porn. I don't mind if people call me a pornographer. But I personally try to make films that are that have a lot more to say than straightforward pornography. My films are often political. They're very narrative. I try to combine unexpected genres together, like horror and a political film, or like a an agitprop film with porn, or horror and gore and porn, or with a political angle. So I try to make a cinematic work.
Well, I mean, like what you were mentioning earlier, Orson Welles' favorite cinematographer, when he wasn't working with Welles, he was working in the porn world.
Yeah, I mean, it wasn't that uncommon. I've talked to lots of people who work in the mainstream film industry who have either dabbled in it or who have always, even Hitchcock or people like the guy that directed Basic Instinct, Paul Verhoeven, who I've interviewed before, expressed interest in making porn. So, porn is interesting because it really is that idea of taboo and of representing that which you are not supposed to represent, especially in a mainstream context. It's that line between what society deems acceptable and what isn't, and that's always, as a filmmaker, a territory that's really interested me, is the unrepresentable, or the line between what you should and shouldn't represent.
Yeah, but as a queer director, what I really want to get into is, again, with the masculinity issue. Ooh. Is that in straight porn here, and I'll name the actors because everybody knows it and they've seen them, Wesley Pipes and Rico Strong, I believe his name is, and I'm going by my notes here, they've made several films where, like I said, there's double penetration, vaginal, anal, oral. Now, these men are not considered to be gay. They're not even considered to be bisexual. And if I say, suggest, well, hey, if you can watch that, then you should be able to watch one of Bruce's films. Oh, hell no, that's a faggot movie. That's a gay film. That's a homosexual movie. That's not gay. And I'm like, yeah, well, their penises are making contact.
Yeah, it's classic denial. It's classic homosexual panic. It's like, as long as both our dicks are in the pussy, it's okay, because the focus is the pussy. So it's just kind of a kind of taboo that people can't get their mind around. Bisexuality is still a great taboo. People don't even want to acknowledge that they could have bisexual impulses. I think that the gay movement has really discouraged that kind of openness, because they are so adamant about this idea that you have to choose a side, that you're either, you're born gay and you can only be gay if you're born gay. And I think, I studied Freud and Kinsey, and there's a lot of opposing opinion about that. A lot of people think that everyone has a kind of bisexual potential, any kind of, Kinsey believed that anyone who suppresses all of their homosexual impulses is straight. I mean, and vice versa. So it's about repression. whether that comes from it might have biological components, and it might have to do with very early infant and childhood experiences, as Freud talked about. I think it's a bit mysterious, but Freud definitely did believe in constitutional bisexuality, where everyone has bisexual potential.
Well, it's been argued, at least one meeting I was at, that 10% of people are definitely heterosexual. 10% of the world's population is definitely homosexual, that these two do not ever cross.
Yeah.
And that the rest of the 80 is somewhere within this gray, fluctuating space.
That's classic Kinsey. You know, Kinsey had the Kinsey scale from 1 to 6. If you're a Kinsey 1, you're 100% heterosexual. If you're a Kinsey 6, you're 100% homosexual. And he found that the vast majority of people were somewhere in the middle.
Yeah, I mean, that seems to be it. And, you know, and again, you know, as a director, as someone who challenges the public with these perspectives and these ideas and these questions, well, and as someone who was challenged.
Yeah, I mean, in Gerontophilia, for example, my new film, the boy, it's about this, 18-year-old boy who has an affair with an 81-year-old man. The boy has a girlfriend. You know, he's 18. He kind of really hasn't figured out his sexuality yet. So he's having sex with a girl, but he discovers he has this, this kind of sexual attraction to the aged. And it's kind of a metaphor for anyone who discovers they have some kind of, fetish or some kind of sexual drive that can't be really explained or kind of doesn't fit into the idea of normalcy. And, you know, his attraction to the elderly overrides conceptions of gender or race, because the old man is black that he falls in love with, or culture. I mean, he's French Canadian and the old man is English Canadian, and so he's transgressing all these kind of barriers. And everyone wants. Everyone always wants you to choose a side. It's like you can't be. Polymorphous,
Have you been asked as an artist to choose a side?
Well, I've always chosen not to choose a side. My films, I've made films about all sorts of characters who have homosexual sex but aren't identified as homosexual themselves. They're not identified as gay. So I've made films about male prostitutes or right-wing skinheads or extreme left-wing revolutionaries who are straight but using homosexuality as a kind of political statement. So I try to keep things fluid. I try to base it on people that I've known in my life who do transgress these barriers and who don't have a fixed, sexual identity. And I find that much more interesting. Like I was saying, in the gay community, I sometimes have a bad reputation because people think I represent homosexuality improperly or give it a kind of a bad name somehow. And I don't see that at all. I mean, my films are very about interesting, empathetic, romantic, emotional characters. And it's just about the idea of appreciating difference and otherness and kind of as opposed to being kind of phobic about it.
Oh, okay. Well, let me ask you again too. I'm sticking to film because I like the work of Derek Jarman, but because of the otherworldliness, I suppose, of a lot of his concepts, people didn't take them as hard, as opposed to when they watch you. When they watch you, it's a little bit like a punch in the face, as opposed to watching Jarman, or maybe even Kenneth Anger. I mean, I find you and Kenneth Anger somehow not the same. I don't want to lump you the same because his thing was very different than yours. You are much more political, but how the visual actually, really just gets people. Like when you look at the film Cruising,
yeah,
And the because I remember when it came out, it was in the theaters for a week.
Oh, I crossed the picket line to see Cruising.
Yeah, you know, I mean, a lot of people were just like, you know, when I actually looked at it, it wasn't bad because I knew someone who was living in New York at the time that the actual killings had occurred. Ooh. And he said it was really, he was in the S&M world, and he said it was very, very terrifying when that was happening because nobody knew. And there's been a couple of cases like that, I believe, in New York City of people yeah. preying on folks in the leather community. So the.
Well, I would quote, you know, we could get into Camille Paglia, who always, you know, argues that sexuality is dangerous sometimes. I mean, sexuality is a very primal force. There's a lot sometimes, and sometimes people are excited by the aspects of it that are dangerous or even violent. I mean, it's not this idea of having some kind of sanitized idea of sexuality, especially now in the gay movement where everything is only about, you know, monogamy and child rearing. And I mean, it really goes against nature in a way. I mean, there is a very kind of primal aspect to sexuality that the gay movement in its militancy in the 60s and the 70s and 80s really tapped into. It was a very sexually militant movement, and there were, you know, sometimes bad consequences to that. But and then AIDS is a whole other discussion. But in my movies, the reason I think regarded a bit different is, like I said, I've unapologetically dabbled in the porn world, and I've made three of my films have hardcore versions that were marketed as porn films. And so I'd make a kind of softcore version for international film festivals or theatrical release, and then I'd under a different title I'd repackage it and sell it in the as a porn movie with the full on long porn scenes with penetration and everything, which I don't think anyone else has really done. I mean,
Actually, Lars von Trier has.
Right, but no, he had a porn company, yeah, absolutely, but he didn't do it with the same film. Like, he didn't make a film, even like an extreme film like Antichrist isn't a porn film.
No.
You know, so, yeah, so that's why I think I have that reputation. Having said that, I'm having a retrospective at the Museum of Modern Art. So, I mean, my films have been recognized as films that talk about porn, that aren't afraid to be pornographic, but that put them in all different kinds of contexts, that relate them to you know, mainstream narrative, that relate them to documentary, that relate them to European art cinema, to independent filmmakers like Cassavetes and Robert Altman. I mean, I have all sorts of influences, but it's the pornographic that some people can't get past. But now I am getting a certain recognition.
Would you see yourself in the same space that Robert Mapplethorpe was in some years back?
Yeah, I would say that's a really good example. I mean, it was so interesting that he was doing these, you know, very heavy S&M photos. The way that he represented black models was unheard of, you know, unapologetically and very adamantly, you know, sexual and
political at the same time. There's this one image that I still remember from his book, was it Black or Black Men? African man holding a Magnum, 357 Magnum, with his arm straight out, aiming at something, with a full erection.
Yeah.
Sticking out of his pair of jeans. And it's like, okay, which one are you really afraid of? One, the other, or both?
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, and you know, I have my the famous scene in Hustler White where a group of black men sort of have a chain, like a kind of a gangbang on a white hustler, and you know, the black queen, who's sort of the madam of this group of black hustlers, makes this white boy go down on him, and he says, here's the real seed of black power, you know. And it was very, it was played for laughs, but it was it's a very interesting scene that that was kind of controversial. I should mention that Oscar White is, it's at the retrospective as well, and it's also coming out on Blu-ray on April 14th, I think. So
okay.
For the 20th anniversary.
What else do you have coming up?
Well, I this retrospective is kind of happening, and then Gerontophilia opens right after the retrospective on May 1st in New York and Los Angeles. It's already been played around the world and opened theatrically in France and a lot of other European countries. And otherwise, now I'm developing two scripts that I hope to do now in the next. The next couple of years.
Okay, so let me ask you as a final question. As a director and as an artist, where do you think the next 5 years, you know, what is it going to look like in terms of, I mean, for lack of a better term, I'm just going to say, I don't know. I mean, there's Vito Russo, and then there's what we think is gay cinema. You know, what I learned from him was it's always been in cinema. So what do you think the view, the image, the perspective of different people is going to be in the next 5 years? You know, considering politically, you know, all of the problems that we're having in North America, you know, how this would be reflected in terms of individuals who are not what the mainstream considers to be, quote unquote, normal.
Well, you know, it's a very complicated issue because homosexuality and gay rights develops obviously internationally around the world on completely different timelines, you know. So what's going on in Russia and I showed my film films like two or three years ago, just before this new wave of homophobia and the anti-gay law. I showed my films in Kiev and Moscow and didn't have a problem. And then now there's this new whole, you know, anti-gay wave that happened, that's partly instigated for political reasons by Putin, and you know, so or you know, in Africa the gay situation in so many places is dire, or in some Muslim countries, so you can't you know, it's hard to talk about it in any kind of broad terms, but in North America, for example, or Western Europe, I think people are going to have to start getting back to their kind of political consciousness a little bit more. This idea of just that you can of the oppressed becoming the oppressor, you know, of the formerly of kind of being involved in the kind of system and kind of supporting and living in the kind of system that was previously the same system that oppressed you and kind of like despised you, and you're gaining access to this club only if you give up that which makes you different and interesting and other, you know, that you have to be able to maintain your difference and your otherness and if that's the price you have to pay to participate in a system that's probably corrupt in the first place, then it's not much of a movement, it's not much of a political strategy. You know, I think people really have to get back to the kind of political consciousness that got them to where they are in the first place.
Okay, yeah, you know, I it's hard to disagree with anything that you're saying, because you're really laying out the basis of how we should be analyzing things, that we should be analyzing things.
Yeah, there should be a political consciousness. I mean, and a class consciousness. I mean, things that were and solidarity between, you know, the black and the gay movement and the feminist movement that happened in the 70s. You know, it's these were oppositional movements. These weren't movements that were trying to. I mean, this idea of, can we have the first, I don't know, like, transsexual president? It's like, why would you want to? Why would you want to be the fucking president? I mean, it's crazy.
Yeah, and I'm, it's you know, I consider it to be gay colonialization.
Absolutely, I agree.
You know, in so many ways that it, you know, what you used to, you know, want. Well, I mean, Common, the rapper singer, he's being raked over the coals right now. So was Raven Simone for basically saying that, you know, black people have never offered a hand to white folks, and we're listening to this, and it's like, what? And someone insulted from Spanish language media, the first lady, Sister Michelle, saying that she looked like someone from the Planet of the Apes.
Yeah.
And this is a newscaster who, you know, should know better. And at the same time, I understand that he is now saying that he comes from a mixed family and some of his family is gay. Right? Because it used to be, well, I have a black friend.
Ooh.
Now it's, I have a gay friend.
Yeah.
Right? And a lot of that, I think, has to do with, you know, being, you're in the mainstream, but you're really not. You know, which is something a lot of minorities can definitely,
I mean, that was an absolutely disgusting and, you know, horrible thing, racist thing that he said. But I also, you have to remember that the original Planet of the Apes, which is a masterpiece, the apes were better looking, smarter, more political. I mean, you know, it was the white colonialist guys who were the monsters, you know, and Zira the Great, you know, the ape in Planet of the Apes. She Charlton Heston says, "I'd like to kiss you," and she goes, "Oh, but you're so damn ugly."
Yeah. Well, as a child, I mean, when I first saw that, when it finally came on television, you know, when it used to take several years before a feature film finally came on public television, it didn't take too long for my family and I to sit there and watch and say, wait a minute, there's a hierarchy here.
Yeah.
Look who's running things. Look who the soldiers are. You know, look who the scientists are. Mm-hmm. Yeah, I mean, that's what I'm talking about. You know, that type of, you know, subversive film that wasn't going out of his, you know, wasn't saying subversive, but just was.
Yeah, it was an allegory, you know. It was about how, you know, white colonial and American, corruption that destroyed the world. I mean, that's what the film is about.
You know? And you know what? You just gave me fodder for the next question, because Gore Vidal wrote the screenplay, or co-wrote it, for Ben-Hur.
Right.
And, yeah. Oh, well, he also did Caligula too, right?
Yeah.
Yeah. So what I was going to ask you was, you know, the scene or the whole understory, because from what I understand, he told, I can't remember his name right now, the Irish actor who passed, who was Charlton Heston.
Huh? Oh, in Ben-Hur, that was Stephen Boyd.
Stephen Boyd. Yeah. Thank you. He told Stephen Boyd, what the undercurrent was, that the two of you had been lovers as young men. But he said, don't tell Heston. I'll talk to him.
Right.
You know, could that happen today? Sure. A person sitting in a movie theater or watching a film and can see the subtext that the straight people cannot see?
Sometimes it's amazing what, like how, I mean, that's what the buddy film is based on. It's like all these homoerotic undertones and kind of homosexual subtext. I just wrote a piece for ID Magazine where I talked about all gay movies are all horror movies, or most horror movies, are about some kind of homosexual panic. Like this idea that we were talking about earlier, you know, or some kind of repressed sexuality coming back in a monstrous form, you know. And it's amazing how it's everywhere and people can kind of not clue into it.
Hey, I clued into it when I first saw Frankenstein. Bruce LaBruce, go check him out at brucelabruce.com. You can check him out on Twitter as well.
It's at Bruce LaBruce Twitter.
Bruce LaBruce. Okay, so there you go. Please check it out. You've been listening to Intelligent Aboriginal Radio. And Bruce, thank you so much for being a guest.
My pleasure.
All right. Stick around. We'll have some audio. I'm sure Lupe will put on somebody. This is Intelligent Aboriginal Radio. Please stay tuned.
not communism. It's moving America toward a fascist theocracy. And everything that's happened during the Reagan administration is steering us right down that pipe.
Oh, Mr. Zappa, Mr. Zappa. Do you really think? All kidding aside, in this country, with the permissiveness that we are moving toward a fascist theocracy, anything goes.
You bet we are, buddy.
Do you think things like this would ever have been permitted?
Smile again.
When we were kids, you're about my age, maybe a little younger. Well, I'm 55. Do you think when I was a kid that they would permit songs like that to be sold? I mean, permissiveness is the game. You're not really serious if you're saying we're going toward a fascist theocracy.
That's right, we are.
Wait a minute.
In what way?
One example of a fascist theocracy.
When you have a government that prefers a certain moral code derived from a certain religion, and that moral code turns into legislation to suit one certain religious point of view, and if that code happens to be very, very right-wing, almost toward Attila the Hun.
Well, then you are an anarchist. Every form of civil government is based on some kind of morality, Frank.
Morality in terms of behavior, not in terms of theology.
It seems like the straight porn world doesn't really overlap with the gay porn world. Is that true or not true?
People make a fuss about it, but at the end of the day, I mean, I won't work with this guy because he does gay porn and he does straight porn. And it's like, no one knows anyone knows off camera. So, and I mean, even with the test, your test is only as good as the day you got tested. So as long as someone has a clean test, I don't feel like they're any more of a risk than anyone else. Because I don't know, at least I know what they do. You know what I mean? It's those people that you find out and you hear stories about that it's like, wow. Wow.
I mean, for example, we're not going to put his name out, but I know of a black male porn star that has had a lot of rumors about him messing with trannies.
So many come to mind.
Really?
Yeah.
I know of one.
I don't know if I could fill up one hand with guys in porn who I can definitely guarantee you are even straight.
Really?
Yes.
So you think that most male porn stars are bisexual?
Yeah.
Really?
Yeah. And nothing's wrong with that. I just wish they'd admit it.
Interesting.
I'm more comfortable with a person who admits it. I don't like when people hide things. For whatever reason, but yeah, like there are straight ones, but they're very few.
Really? So, what percentage of male porn stars do you feel are bisexual?
More than half.
60%, 70%,
75%.
3 out of 4.
Yeah.
So 3/4 of the male porn stars you watch on camera are having sex with men as well.
I think so.
Off camera.
I think so.
Interesting. I've never heard that before.
That's my opinion. I mean, just because of things that I've heard, things that I observe, things that you know, guys will tell me. You know, there are not all of them are in the closet about it. Some of them are honest. Then there's ones who are like, I'm not gay. I just like trannies. And it's like, okay. And it's like, I'm not gay. He sucked my dick. And it's like, all right. Like, there's very few guys who are not about that at all. You know what I mean? Like, who are just like, no. Like, the kind of, yeah. There's very few.
Pictures of New York on the screen. My mother explained that what went on up there was vastly different from real life. And she was wrong. Because everyone who comes from London to New York and goes back says one thing first. It's more like the movies than you'd ever dream. And it is.
Only 28% of Americans believe in evolution.
62% want creation science taught along with evolution in our schools.
44% want creation science taught exclusively.
You are all about to learn that you didn't come from monkeys and slime. All of you were created in the image and likeness of God.
But didn't we evolve from prior organisms?
Yes, we did. Those organisms were named Adam and Eve.
Then why do we share 99% of our DNA with chimpanzees?
The Bible doesn't teach about chimpanzees.
What about redundant DNA and junk DNA? Does the Bible teach about that?
Well, I can tell you one thing. There's no redundant DNA in hell.
Our children are our future.
Let's try not to turn them into dangerous idiots.
This is FSNN reporter MJ Del Valle in Tbilisi, Georgia. Free Speech Radio News has been an essential outlet for my stories from the Caucasus region, including in-depth looks at the recent Armenian presidential election, the creative ways protesters in Azerbaijan are using to fight for freedom of expression, and labor struggles in the Republic of Georgia. But FSRN, along with the voices of people struggling for dignity, equality, and human rights, could be silenced. Find out how can you support independent grassroots journalists at FSRN.org.
Hey, this is Angie B, vocalist of Love Spirals and hostess of The Chillcast and The Chillcast Video Edition. Each week, The Chillcast brings you a sophisticated mix of pod-safe electronica, world beat, smooth jazz, and soulful pop music that's just right for chillin'. Plus, weekly music videos, monthly CD contests, extended DJ mixes on holidays, and the occasional artist feature. Plus, many specially cleared artists. Some say I'm the queen of chill, and many say I have the sexiest voice in podcasting, but I'll let you be the judge. So come kick back, relax, let me soothe you and groove you on the Chillcast. Chillcast. Come check it all out at my official site at angieb.com. See you there.
Sad motherfucking news, freedom fighter Leonard Peltier was denied parole. Peltier is a member of AIM, or American Indian Movement, and has been in prison for more than 36 years for allegedly killing two FBI agents during a gun battle at the Pine Ridge Reservation. Peltier will not be eligible for parole until 2024. Our hearts are with you, hermano.
Known as normal. When I founded the organization in 1970 to create a national discussion on the need to legalize marijuana for responsible adult use, no one honestly believed that 36 years later, marijuana would still be an illegal and untaxed commodity. However, since Normal began this important advocacy effort, 12 states have decriminalized the possession of marijuana, and 11 states have passed medical marijuana laws or voter initiatives, meaning that over one-third of the American population lives in a state or municipality that has reformed their marijuana laws. Isn't it time that Congress step in and pass national legislation to reform marijuana laws? Let's finish the job of legalizing marijuana once and for all by you and your like-minded friends joining and supporting Normal's longstanding advocacy. You can learn more about Normal's marijuana law reform efforts or become an active supporter by calling toll-free 888-67-NORMAL or by visiting www.normal.org.
Now that America has a black president, is this proof that racism is a thing of the past?
Well, I think white men were 100% of the people that wrote the Constitution, 100% of the people who signed the Declaration of Independence, 100% of the people who died at Gettysburg and Vicksburg, probably close to 100% of the people who died at Normandy. This has been a country built basically by white folks in this country who were 90% of the entire nation. I think they ought to do. They ought to defend the legitimate rights of white working class folks who are the victims of discrimination.
With white people showing love like this, who needs enemies? Intelligent Aboriginal Media. The anti-colonial cure for mental slavery.
Hey, I want to inform you that the Sodomites led a protest against our church this past Sunday. Several members of the Pennsylvania Oath Keepers came up. You know, the fellows that was with us there in Gettysburg. Well, we had a special meeting this Sunday here at the church, and they came up and we were meeting, and someone informed me that the Sodomites were outside of our church protesting. So we went out and took a look, and they were. And they had a big bucket of Starbucks coffee and all kind of other Starbucks paraphernalia with them. And they were all shouting, "Stop the hate now." They said that this church is a hate church and that I'm a hate preacher. But you remember that last week we appeared in several major online news services, Huffington Post being a major one, The Inquisitor being another. What else? Gay Star News, I think, was one. And just several papers wrote articles about us because we had stated that Starbucks is ground zero for Ebola. And we pointed up how these homosexual sodomite persons such as Dr. Craig Spencer, who lives right here in the Harlem area, who is a sodomite, that they frequent, that Starbucks is a place where these types frequent and a lot of body fluids are exchanged there. And Ebola, but the thing that I was not aware of is that there had been some information that had been released, and the Inquisitor News online news service carried this as a major story the week before, that what Starbucks was doing is that they were taking specimens of male semen and they were putting it in the blends of their lattes. Now, this is the absolute truth. It's right there. You can see it right there in Inquisitor Online Services. It was a big article about an investigation into Starbucks using male semen and putting it into the blends of coffees that they sell. I mean, can you imagine it? And I believe that they were doing that. You know, Coca-Cola got started at, 100 years ago by using cocaine. They were actually using cocaine. And they stayed off the federal government and the use of cocaine, because during the time they were used, there was no FDA, there was no Federal Drug Administration, there was no really, drugs that were controlled substance drugs. And so they used it for a large number of years, people were drinking Coca-Cola and getting high on the farm. I mean, you could drink a Coca-Cola at night and wouldn't need any Johnny Walker. He didn't need any gin. Drink gin because it ain't no sin, no vodka either. All you need was Coca-Cola. And people are drinking Coca-Cola you won't believe. But the deal is this. The deal is that Starbucks has been, what's the word I'm looking for? Legally accused of, this is the word, legally accused of using male semen in their lattes. So when you drink Starbucks coffee, it's right there. See it right there. I'm not making this up. Inquisitor is a reputable online service, and they wrote 3 pages on this, the event. And the FDA is investigating. A lot of other people are investigating as well. So my question is, where are they getting all this semen from? You ever go to the doctor and he tells you that, well, I don't want to go there, but you understand what they tell you and you bring back the cup. Well, my suspicion is that they're getting this semen from sodomites. That's what my suspicion is. And somebody has discovered that semen, like cord blood, you know what cord blood is? Well, I don't have time to tell you if you know what cord blood is. My suspicion is that semen, like cord blood, has the opportunity, and it has millions and millions of little zygotes in it, and it flavors up the coffee. And it makes you think you're having a good time drinking that cup of latte with the semen in it. This is what the Inquisitor, I'm not making this up. That's why Starbucks jumped all over me when I said that Ebola, that Starbucks was ground zero for Ebola. Now I know why I don't go to Starbucks. But now I know why all these other, you know, untoward types hang around in Starbucks. This investigation has not been closed as of yet. Going back to the original story. So they came and they protested outside of our church this past weekend. Yeah, they did. And so I suppose that they'll be back again and again and again. But I want to serve notice on everybody that will listen. I want to tell you that in not too many days, there will not be a public sodomite in Harlem. From 96th Street to 155th Street, river to river, there will not be a public sodomite. I'm going to tell you that. Now, you know, I've said a lot of things over the years. Many of them you questioned. A number of them you kind of got in the groove of. Others you didn't believe. But all of them have come true. I want to tell you that there will not be a public sodomite in Harlem in not too many days. And Starbucks will close. Starbucks will be found to be perverting its customers and perverting human sexuality as if drinking Starbucks is some sort of a sacrificial ritual bath where they kill the innocent babies and drink their blood in some of these meetings that are had by these fraternal or sorority groups. Starbucks has for years been using sexual fluids to prosper their businesses, and the truth is now coming out. According to Inquisitor magazine, New York Times will not write about it, and others who have a sodomite propensity will not lift up the story, but the truth is going to come out. Me, I'm James David Manning, everybody. I'm the Lord's servant.
You are listening to Angry Indian Radio, the podcast of the Aboriginal Press News Service.
Belle moustache, le souci noir, le regard clair, un peu bourru, un peu bravache, pour nous c'était presque un père. Joli cœur, sous une peau de vache, grand cœur sans en avoir l'air. Révolutionnaire sans tache, oui, Staline est exemplaire. C'est la lutte finale.
Ok, vive la rose.
Coupons-nous cette main.
Ok, vive la rose.
Car l'international,
vive la rose et le lilas,
sera le genre humain.
Vive la rose et le jasmin.
Au vrai et paysan, nous sommes le grand parti des travailleurs. La terre n'appartient qu'aux hommes.